Welcome back to the Roundtable on Valentine's Day. What could be more romantic than blabbing about politics for 84 minutes? It's the Roundtable panel. And, what a panel we have today. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here, Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith, and communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois. And as we begin the panel, we invite your participation, limited participation. You can email panel@WAMC.org, panel@WAMC.org. I say limited because we would like the emails brief, concise, cogent, to the point.
And should we announce that Teresa has brought us a wonderful Valentine's repast here this morning?
Oh, yes. You brought cupcakes.
Valentine's
lovely.
Cupcakes of your choice.
Well, that's so
from
nice.
From the lovely Schuyler Bakery.
Would you like one, Alan?
Oh, I would like one, but I'm not going to have one.
Just go crazy on it. It even has a little ring on top. You can put your Valentine's ring on your finger.
Oh, that's great.
Or you can have one that says any number of little sayings there and little sprinkles.
No,
and
no,
little bring a sweetheart thing to your lovely wife.
No, I was specifically prohibited by Roselle for buying anything. Who gave me the lecture, you know, about the card companies.
She sounds like a girl after my own heart.
Oh, yeah.
Card company thing. I'm not getting you anything, and you should not get me anything.
That's nice.
That puts you in a very bad situation because you don't really, really know what she really wants you to do. You know what I mean?
Didn't you buy her a huge box of candy one year?
I did. I went into the CVS and they had this. They had about
right down the road, right?
They had about 9 different boxes of hearts of candy. So I said, and I was a devil, I'll tell you.
Yes.
And I saw.
What do you mean was?
Yeah. And I saw the biggest one I have ever seen in my whole life. You could hardly get it through the door. And I think this'll fix her. So I got this gigantic box of candy, you know, see? And I brought it home, and she said, out!
So he brought, out! He brought it to the station.
Oh.
Worked out for
she
everybody.
She chucked it back at you.
Once again, the email address here is panel@WAMC.org. Again, keep the letters brief. Don't include links. Don't use abbreviations. Please proofread if you can. And one email per day per customer. Alan Chartok is here. Jen Smith, communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Anybody watch the Olympics?
Oh, I watched Sean White.
Sean White, third gold.
So my goodness.
Now,
that was crazy.
Snowboarding is relatively new. Snowboarding is about 20 years
in
now.
What exactly is it?
You go on a half pipe on a snowboard.
You just fly through the air with this board attached to both of your legs and flip. It was.
So it's like a board instead of skis? Is that what it is?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
But you're in what they call a half pipe. And so
I don't know what that means.
It's a picture a pipe, only a half of one.
Cut in half, filled
oh,
with
I
ice
see. Yeah,
and
yeah,
snow.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay,
and
I get that.
And you're doing all sorts of aerial stunts.
You go to the edge and it flips you up
inverted
in the air.
Inverted 540s.
But he made 4 full revolutions.
Yeah.
In the air.
And he's like in his 30s.
He went up in the
30,
air and
34,
then
I think?
4 times around before he landed.
That's pretty
unbelievable.
Exciting.
It
yeah.
was unbelievable.
Now, Teresa, I hate to say this, but I was watching. I got to bed at 7 o'clock, and I get up at 2.
Right. Yeah.
So I was watching the CNN, not the CVS, but the CNN. everything in the Berkshires takes the you know,
yeah,
before it. Okay.
Right.
So I was watching the CNN, and they did the whole thing about him and his parents, and you know everybody growing. And then they said that there had been a Me Too incident with him too.
Which he now this morning is saying that this is gossip. He is casting that aside. I'm sure we'll find out more as that goes on.
Yeah.
There was a great article in the AP, the piece in the AP that filed this morning about older Olympians becoming the norm.
Right.
There's a 50-year-old curler from Canada named Cheryl Bernard. She's the oldest Olympian at the Winter Games.
But that is such a stupid sport. That shouldn't be there, should it?
Curling?
Yeah, curling is stupid.
You don't want to say
all
that.
Of Canada.
You do not want to say that.
You don't?
No.
Well, what is it?
Wrath will come down upon you.
I don't get it. You go up next to this thing and you're looking at it and all like that.
People love it.
Yeah.
When I used to work in Michigan, they loved it. They loved
it. Very relaxing.
I'm sure there are people
It's enjoying a revival. My cousin is out in the kind of Worcester area, and we'll just pass there, almost Boston, and they have like a curling club.
Oh, my gosh. There's a curling club in Albany and Schenectady, all around.
I was there. Yep.
There's a 45-year-old Japanese ski jumper, Noriaki Kasai.
Wait. apparently I put my foot in it, but I said it was stupid because it looked stupid to me. So I want to apologize to all those people.
You better, because
it's a 16th century sport I just looked up. So it's survived the times. It's survived all the naysayers.
You don't
want to
denigrate curling. There's a whole curling culture.
What's sporting about it?
What's sporting about golf? You hit a ball as far away from you as possible, and then you walk toward it, and then you hit it away from you again, and you hit it away from you again.
No.
Let's talk about these athletes.
If you ever saw the movie, the Legend of Bagger Vance.
There's a Vermont athlete.
Yeah. Okay.
There's New York. What about the New York athlete? What was he, Luge, from right around here, right?
Let the record show, 19 minutes after 9, I've lost control of the program, so that was
pretty
good.
What about Chloe Kim?
First generation
immigrant. Her parents immigrated here.
And what did she do again? She was a skier? No, a half pipe also?
Half pipe. And she tweeted out just before her run that she wanted some ice cream and then proceeds to do this incredible run. Yeah.
The luge, woman's luge participant from Remsen, New York, she had a horrible
crash
in her last run the other day. And she was in medal contention, and then, but still. It's exciting. There's a 45-year-old ski jumper, a 45-year-old German speed skater, a 39-year-old captain of the U.S. hockey team.
Any 76-year-old?
But some of the cross country skiers are also older.
A little long in the tooth.
Not long in the tooth. They're the best athletes
but
in the world.
The point of the matter is, and the only reason I brought this up was that athletes are going longer and longer. Science and knowledge about nutrition and all these things.
We're all living longer.
Yeah.
Aren't we?
I don't know. So far.
You take a look at the stats, we're all living a little bit longer now.
Are you enjoying watching the Olympics, Alan?
I don't watch the Olympics because I'm in bed at 7:30.
Yeah, but it's on early in the morning on cable. You can watch it live.
You could watch ice dancing pairs. All right. Quite
beautiful. I like that. I like that.
People are going to complain, so let's get down to it. Three of the nation's top intelligence officials confirmed Tuesday that they've seen evidence of Russian meddling in the upcoming midterm elections. Part of what they say is Moscow's escalating cyber assault on American and European democracies. We have seen Russian activity and intentions to have an impact on the next election cycle, CIA Director Mike Pompeo told the Senate Intelligence Committee. National Intelligence Director Dan Coats and Admiral Mike Rogers, the head of the National Security Agency, agreed that Russia's interference is ongoing. This is not going to change or stop, Rogers said. They didn't describe the activity. But Coates did say, while they historically, the Russians, have historically tried to do these types of things, clearly in 2016, they upped their game. They took advantage, a sophisticated advantage of social media. The three testified in Congress on the same day that the Intelligence Committee released its annual report on global threats. The report predicted Russian intelligence activities will disseminate more false information over Russian state-controlled media and through fake online personas to spread anti-American views and exacerbate social and political divides in the United States.
Okay, so let's get this right, because I think it's important we get it right. You get a president of the United States who appoints the head of the CIA, who appoints the head of national intelligence, who appoints the head of the FBI, who does all of these things, and they all come out and they're unified. The Russians are no good nicks. Get it? No good nicks. And they are interfering with American democracy. The worst thing that could be done, it's an act of war. In so many ways, it's an act of war. What does the president of the United States, who's under investigation for basically whether or not he colluded with the Russians? He's saying, I don't believe they did anything. Wait. Whoa. The very people he appointed, right? The very people he appointed, all the top security officials are saying as one, they're doing it. They're doing it. They did it, and they're doing it, and they're going to do it in the future.
But what are they doing?
We don't have a strategy to meet that with. And that, when they say, "Well, what is your strategy?" the senator say to him, "Is well, that comes from the president of the United States, who isn't creating a strategy." Now, what did you want to say, Ray?
My question was what. What are they doing? In other words, there have now been some suggestions that they attempted to actually access voting mechanisms.
And that they successfully.
But did they change votes? That's truly the question. In other words, the propaganda game has been played since Stalin time, right?
Well, that makes it all right.
No, I'm not saying it makes it all right.
But with Facebook, with all the social media, it's at a whole new level. But They, the Homeland Security person, testified last week that the previous reports were that they had attempted to access 21 different states voting. And only last week they then announced that, well, in fact, they successfully accessed a number of them. They wouldn't say what number. Now, it's not that they weren't going to talk about what happened. They just said they were going to do it in private session yesterday afternoon. So the intelligence, there were two parts to yesterday's Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. One was an open session, mm-hmm. and the other was a closed session. Mm-hmm. And so when they were asked for specifics, they said they wanted to talk about that in closed session, both about what had occurred and what was going to be done about it.
And I think it's about the next steps. I mean, we know this. We know that since, the Washington Post did a story back in November about how, Russian meddling has existed since the era and it was a headache under Ulysses S. Grant. We know that's an issue, right? So what are we doing about it? We have all this intelligence. How do we prevent that? And what, should sanctions happen? At all.
Which the Congress voted for.
This to me is astounding. The Congress, there are legislatively mandated sanctions against Russia. Mm-hmm. There was a deadline in which the Trump administration was required to impose them, and they have let the deadline pass. And how is that not an assault on our democracy?
And that's really what needs the government needs to be held accountable to. It doesn't matter the rhetoric around it. It means, why did we let this deadline lapse?
Well, Dan Coats, who's the a former U.S. senator.
Former Republican, right-wing U.S. senator.
Very, very conservative. He is now the director of national intelligence, and he said there are two things that you need to do. That the central challenges are to contain or contend with the flow of, and I'm quoting here, the flow of Russian misinformation and shoring up the defense of our electoral system. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem that the Trump administration is focused on either of those.
Except when it comes, Teresa, to saying the way we're going to shore up the electoral system is by making sure that it's more difficult to vote on the part of very many people, often whom are Black, Hispanic, or poor. And that has always been the way the Republicans have approached this, quote, of security measures.
And we know now that that's the wrong approach, that it should be. We should be looking at our electoral system all around, whether it's just cybersecurity to, what we're doing about gerrymandering. I think that's still an issue that affects the outcomes of our elections, both internationally and domestically.
Right. I mean, there really is an assault on the, not an assault, but there's the, our election process in this country is in turmoil right now between with the court issues around gerrymandering and with these cyber attacks. And all of these are done at the state and the local level, but you need federal assistance to deal with these problems.
And I want to get back to the president in all of this. The president gets elected. He has only good things to say about Commissar Putin from the very beginning. He says it again and again and again. Putin's good. I like the guy, all the rest of that stuff, and he's going to be a good ally. In the meantime, all his top intelligence people are saying, nonsense, he's not a good guy. They are trying to corrupt our system, and the president goes forward, and he's under investigation for that. And the question is, why does he go forward and refuse to carry out the mandate, Teresa, that the Congress, everybody except two people said.
Didn't carry out the legislatively mandated sanctions. And when the intelligence folks were asked yesterday by the senators if they had been directed to combat Russia, right. they said they had not been directed to specifically combat Russian interference. I mean, that's astounding. That testimony was astounding. That was chilling.
You know, this may, the 2016 election may go down as a teachable moment for the American voting population. Senator James Risch, I believe, of Idaho, maybe it's Reich, said he thinks the American people are better prepared to deal with Russian influence in campaigns than before. They have started to look askance in social media and attempts to influence their opinion. And he said, quote, "The American people are smart people. They realize that there are people attempting to manipulate them, both domestically and foreign." Isn't an educated population the key to fighting propaganda and misinformation?
Well, not Hillary Clinton, during the campaign, she warned Russia's interfering with the election. And the media at that point essentially mocked her and said that she was just trying to distract from her own troubles. I mean, it's very hard. Recently,
what were those troubles?
When the
manipulating her own primary against Bernie Sanders?
Don't even, Ray.
All right. Just
because Bernie Sanders could not organize his own.
There was a little collusion there.
Get support from superdelegates. That's not her fault that he could not get support from superdelegates. Yeah.
But I think quickly to answer the question, too, it's a story that I'm working on right now is, what happened to teaching civics in school? What happened to that? And, we're finding that it's not there. You know, we talked to our neighbors in Vermont. They actually have just come up with a new set of curriculum requirements that will push this back into the understanding of the young population. But yeah, it's something that has to be done.
We are joined today by Jen Smith of the Berkshire Eagle, Teresa Bourgeois, communications consultant, and WAMC's Alan Shartok. The email address here is panel@WAMC.org if you want to weigh in, and we'll get to some of your emails after the break. panel@WAMC.org. It's the roundtable on a Valentine's Day and how romantic it is. Time for some cupcakes. We'll take a break for Brit News. Lark Blakey and the Jazz Messengers here on the roundtable, 9:34 Wednesday morning. Ray Graffin for Joe Donahue on a Valentine's Day edition of the roundtable panel. And Alan Shartok is on the panel today, Jen Smith from the Berkshire Eagle, and Teresa Bourgeois. You, of course, can weigh in at panel@WAMC.org. And Alan, some people have done just that.
Yes, they have, Ray. I'm glad you mentioned it.
Yes.
Did they tell you what to get for...
They did. For example, Tracy, Valentine's advice for Alan.
Oh, nice.
Good morning, Alan and panel. Try writing a heartfelt letter to your wife expressing why you love her.
Or you could just have one of your underlings do it for you. Sign your name. Done.
Ray, this is sweet.
Cost is minimal, and it will be cherished. I can't do it, Tracy. I'll tell you why. Because there isn't enough paper in the whole world.
Now I'm going
to
be ill.
For me to write all the reasons I love the lovely Roselle.
Okay, so we can only infer that Roselle is listening, and in which case a shout out to Roselle this morning on Valentine's Day.
That was a lovely thought, though.
It was.
That was a beautiful
thought. Jay said...
He says flowers.
Curling.
I thought Jay was going to talk about flowers.
I suggest
daisies.
In big block letters, how dare you insult curling, Alan?
Exactly.
You were warned.
Question mark.
You were warned, Alan. You cannot insult curling.
Curling's fun.
There's a whole curling community.
Rochelle says, Olympics commentary. Dear panel, the Olympics commentary this morning was so painful to listen to. Please stick to what you know. I love listening to journalists and political scientists talk about politics. But as a radio station, you want to talk about sports, hire a sports commentator. Hey, there's nobody better about sports than Ari Graff.
I think it was just kind of a casual, have you watched the Olympics? Weighing in on the value of the half pipe.
I was really the editor. I was the sports editor of my college newspaper.
Were you really?
I was.
Well, yeah. Darn. A lot of curling articles?
Really, says Rochelle. Your Olympics knowledge was out of touch. I was wincing the entire time.
I wince a lot during
the entire
program.
Time?
So, okay. I'm with you with that there.
Jim said, Russian interference. Dear panel, assuming that everything is being done to counter hacking, data access, theft, and tampering, how do you then counter propaganda and agitprop in a free society? It was mentioned earlier that it is as old as politics. Jim from Bennington. Okay. And then,
I think you have different degrees.
Martin, who often writes very good letters, okay. Russian interference. Instead of attempting the monumentally difficult task of trying to prevent Russian cyber interference through social media, how about we improve the education?
Done. That is exactly what I said, Martin.
And it's also, not only did you say it, but, you know, you're just a person. But but Jen is writing a series of articles about this for the Berkshire Eagle.
I see.
Okay.
All right.
About
how we improve the
education
system and company so people can see nonsense when they read it. Given the state of our education department, this is obviously not a GOP priority.
it is that way because it benefits them. In other words, people not being good about, annoying about this. And that's from Marty.
Marty has me thinking about diverting the topic.
You want to check in on that, Jen, because you're writing on this subject right now.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And I think as we look at the first year, not only of Trump in office, but some of his administrative leaders like Betsy DeVos in the Education Department, you know, what's being done to repair in our education systems, to progress them, to, you know, mandate curriculum that helps people.
How about civics classes? Yeah. Remember those?
Well, what are we learning about the Constitution by the behavior of this president,
I was like, I can get really into the weeds on this, and I won't because we have a lot to talk about. But, you know, overall, I think you can find evidence that these courses still exist. There's actually some really fabulous modern civics classes going on. There's a few problems with what's being offered, though. One, in a lot of cases, it's being offered as an elective versus being a part of a mandate. In Massachusetts, for example, we didn't really have the funding and there wasn't enough. It wasn't well organized. The history MCAS exam, the state testing exam for that subject area. So therefore, you don't see a lot of mandates with that. Another issue is scheduling. Because it's not a tested priority, you're just not going to see a lot of emphasis on these things. Not to say that there aren't some great social studies, history, English language arts teachers who are integrating into their curriculum. I've seen it done really well from seniors in high school having a voter registration day and actually taking walks as a class to their local town office to register. You know, there are great things like that happening on. The thing is, it's not happening in every place.
So is the Berkshire Eagle doing anything? I mean, shouldn't everybody get, I used to insist that everybody in my class get the New York Times every day.
Mm-hmm.
Is the Berkshire Eagle, you know, putting out, you know, the paper so that every student gets to read it every morning?
Yep, we have our newspapers and education program, which some of our subscribers support. We're thankful for that.
Yeah.
And we have in the Berkshires, and I'm sure in this area, I'm hoping in this area, we have some K-12 journalism programs that exist. And I think, but training them, it's one thing to put the newspaper in front of people. It's another thing to train them how to vet it, how to understand it, how to look at multiple sources, how to ask questions. I think one of the biggest detriments in society is telling people to sit down and be quiet and to not ask questions. I think there's a lot of problem with just on the spot critical thinking and saying, you know, does this sound fishy? What is the evidence? We deal so much with polling. This is one of my biggest pet peeves. We talk about percentages and statistics, but you don't ask the methodology. We don't look at the hard math behind it. And you look at these sampling sizes, and it's a fraction of the, you know, millions of people who live in the United States. And, you know, it's a polling sample of 1,000. Yes, there's some strategy behind it, but you have to keep things. When you look at studies, when you're pushing evidence, you see a lot of back and forth between you know, different sides, and they'll cite this study or that study, but what's the strength of that study that they're citing?
Well, but that really is in the weeds in a way. I mean, you take a look at something, for example, over in the Berkshires right now, a major controversy, which is a great teaching moment, which is that the Berkshire Museum has been given the go-ahead to sell these Rockwell paintings with some modifications, but basically do that. So there are two sides to that. And I notice in the Eagle every day there are letters, for example, from people on the museum side. Clearly, they have gotten their stuff together in order to load the letters column. So it would be great, it seems to me. That's a great teaching moment to say this is what people in a democracy can do. Mm-hmm. They can, you know, alter the perception of what's really going on by doing propaganda of one kind or another. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I think that's, you know, again, part of if there were to be media literacy or just understanding how society works, how civics works, how government works. You have to show up to participate. Hopefully you show up with a little bit of background knowledge. You have to understand who's talking. You know, if you're looking at a story or if you're attending a meeting, who's getting up to speak? Is it just the bureaucrats? Do we have neighbors who are closer to the issue? Do we have people affected by these things weighing in? Are there equal amounts of voices? So those are things you have to pay attention to as well.
But you can have all the civics education in the world. But look, recently we were talking about the hashtag release the memo. This is when Nunes had his memo and he wanted it out there. And there was a little Republican effort to distract attention by the hashtag release the memo. Well, reports after the fact were that the Russians may have been involved in generating more attention on that issue and generating more, hashtag. So even if you are highly educated and informed, how would you know that the Russians were involved and raising the volume on that effort?
You know to ask, and I think people knew that there was information, by asking questions, well, who knows what about what? And so I think that's what happened in this case. How did we even know that a memo existed? Because people were asking about it.
You knew a memo because there was a concentrated effort in coordination with Sean Hannity at Fox to... he had a special show and launched this Release the Memo effort. It was an orchestrated campaign.
That's right.
In the U.S.
That's exactly what I was trying to say.
It was
about
an
the
orchestrated
museum.
Campaign in the U.S., but layered onto that, by all accounts now, the Russians weighed in and amplified that in a distorted way to get the outcome that they were hoping, sowing more chaos in the U.S. conversation. So you can be educated but not know that Russians were involved in that.
Well, I think even if, an information like that is released, people still have to be able to put it into context. What does this mean? You could have all the information in the world in front of you, but if you don't understand how to vet it, understand how it impacts your lives, impacts, public programs, future decision-making in government, then you're still at a loss.
Yeah, so, for example, you're quite right. This morning... the president's one of the president's lawyers, Stephen Cohen, is that his name?
Michael,
Stephen, whatever, Mr. Cohen.
Had
this to say. He said, "I gave the money to to the porno star personally. It did not come out of anybody's campaign contribution. And oh, by the way, I'm writing a book on all of my relationships with the Trump people and everything that's going on." Well, if you're saying that, one and one makes two, okay? Now this guy is proudly taking credit for this, but also saying that he's writing a book and he's shopping it around to publishers about his unique relationship, and he gave that money, don't you think?
WAMC's Alan Shartok is on the panel today. Berkshire Eagle reporter Jen Smith and communications consultant Teresa Bourgeois, and the email address here is panel@wamc.org. Big DACA ruling yesterday in U.S. District Court. We'll take a break and talk about that. It's the Roundtable on WAMC 947 on a Wednesday, Valentine's Day. Ray Graff, in for Joe Donahue, Teresa Bourgeois, Alan Shartok, and Jen Smith on the panel, and you at panel@wamc.org. Teresa, you have done some fabulous research on Valentine's Day and the origins.
Yes, I'm sad to report.
I'd love to hear about this.
So the Valentine's Day, the Roman Emperor Claudius.
Yeah, I Claudius.
269 to 270, he was a Roman emperor. And during that time, he was persecuting Christians.
He was only emperor for 1 year?
Yep, 269 to 270.
He was an overachiever.
Yeah.
All right, continue.
He died of the plague. In any case, they were at war. And he declared that soldiers could not get married because he felt that soldiers were better if they were unmarried because then they weren't worrying about getting home to their wives and their children.
Right.
So he banned marriage. And Father Valentine, began to secretly marry people. And it was found out that he was doing this, so he was arrested and ultimately killed on February 14th.
Oh.
He was a martyr for his efforts to marry people secretly.
This is the origins
of Valentine's
sort
Day.
Of a Memorial he was a, Day then.
Yeah.
A martyr. He was a martyr for marriage. He became known as the patron saint of lovers and marriage.
Think about that as you have your candy, right?
Right.
What a sad day it is. Well, thank you for that.
So that's sad thing. Now, a happy thing is, what should Alan get his lovely wife?
Oh, I don't know.
Flowers.
What do you give the girl who has everything, right?
She does
a generator.
Almost everything. I gave her a generator, but that was last year.
You got her a generator for Valentine's Day?
It's a very romantic gift.
She didn't want it, believe me.
No wonder she said, don't get me anything this year.
I got you a circular saw, honey. Hey, it's really nice. The Department of Justice says it's looking forward to the next stage of litigation following a New York judge's ruling against the government's handling of the end of a program that spared some young immigrants from deportation. Department spokesman Devin O'Malley says the U.S. District Court judge's decision doesn't change the fact that the Deferred Action for Children Arrivals program was an unlawful circumvention of Congress. The program was implemented while Barack Obama was president and protected many young immigrants from deportation if they were brought to the U.S. as children. President Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions said last summer the program was going to end, leading to a lawsuit. A federal judge in New York has ruled that President Trump's administration did not offer legally adequate reasons for ending the program. U.S. District Judge Nicholas Garufas said in an order issued Tuesday, the Republican president indisputably has the power to end the DACA program, but relied on flawed legal positions in doing so.
Yeah. So this is court case number two.
That's correct.
Another victory for the state's attorneys general who sued. And we'll see, you know, right now in the Senate, they're struggling over the language for an immigration bill or a DACA bill. It's not clear to me yet if McConnell really wants to pass something or he wants to just say that he kept his promise to keep a bill on the floor. It seems that there are a number of potential compromises that would settle this issue, and he's not letting those come to the floor.
Now, Teresa, there is this internal working group of Republicans and Democrats who want to get something done.
Right.
Who apparently are offering some hope that they can come up with a compromise on the DACA. But I don't know what that's going to look like.
Well, you know, apparently there is a compromise. The question is, will McConnell allow it to come up for a vote? Because if it came for a vote, it would pass. Now, Trump's people put out the word yesterday that he wouldn't sign it. And so I think that was another effort to slow this down. I don't know if they want the issue or they want to resolve it.
Sure.
Well, it seems now that they more want to the issue rather than to resolve it, they being the Republicans. The Democrats and a group of Republicans, they have a path forward. It's just their path is being blocked.
And to add on to that, I think one of the issues, too, is that, you know, the figure we keep hearing is the 1.8 million people. So it's more than the 690,000, you know, just those individuals who are identified as DACA eligible. But it allows for, a few more people. Well, more than a few, I guess.
But 600,000 is a little more than a few.
But I think one of the other issues that's come up that maybe isn't talked about so much is the issue of what funding is being made available for legal immigration in general. And from what I understand, that's been cut. And so I think that's a point of contention for especially the Democrat advocates who have been really holding the line on you know, not yielding to a compromise. And I think that's been a point of contention as well.
And the reason the funding is important is that you need a system in place where you can process these folks so they can move through the system legally, mm-hmm. so that they can move there is a path to citizenship with the processes in place to get them there, because there is a huge backlog.
And there's still not a lot of talk about what's the U.S. plan for long-term, you know, immigration reform. If that's something that's really wanted, this still somewhat looks like a short-term Band-Aid solution.
But what's interesting to me is, Alan, you talked about the group of people, bipartisan group of people in the Senate and in the House, and two of the people who are leading that effort are people from a Republican congressman from California and a Republican congressman from Texas, both of whom are districts are along the border.
Sure.
And so for those who are right in the thick of it, they want a solution to this. Mm-hmm. And there are paths forward.
Or, as you had said, I'm sorry for interrupting, but or as you said before, they want to seem like they want a solution to this.
Well, no, these two are actually working toward a solution that includes some combination of increased border security mm-hmm. and a pathway to citizenship for these folks. But it's others, the Freedom Caucus folks. Really, you know, your fundamental problem is you have Stephen Miller and General Kelly in the White House who seem to be trying to block progress on this. I think that's one of the fundamental problems.
But you also have a president of the United States who consistently lies. He said on several occasions he wants a solution to DACA and he wants a DACA bill. But you know what? He also puts out this counter statement that says, we'll veto it
if
you come
up
with something.
Right.
And for the people who are affected the most, the people who are covered under this bill whose livelihoods are at stake, you know, the clock is ticking towards that deadline. And they're still sort of in limbo in terms of anyone who's in the pipeline for, having a legalized status. What does that mean? I can't imagine being an immigration lawyer right now.
And I don't know with this court ruling yesterday and the previous one from California, I don't know what that does to the March 5th deadline. Because at some point, I mean, is there a rush to bring it to the Supreme Court? They're not going to rule before March 5th. I mean, what happens?
The judge ordered the Trump administration to allow people already in the DACA program to continue enjoying protections, but he declined to extend the program for new applicants. That was yesterday's ruling. Interesting.
Gets appealed, though. They'll appeal that, right? We're waiting to find out today, I think, if the San Francisco decision gets appealed.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, of course, if there is legislation that is ultimately signed, then the appeals will
then
go
none
away.
Of this matters.
Right.
What you really need is a legislative solution because Trump created this artificial deadline of March 5th. This is a completely artificial Trump-created deadline. You need a legislative resolution.
One interesting thing, and I'd love to get a legal expert on here at some point, in the decision, and I'm having trouble wrapping my head around this, the judge said the president indisputably has the power to end DACA, but he relied on flawed legal positions to do so. Does it matter what he relies on if ultimately he has indisputable power to end the program?
I'm wondering that myself.
That's an interesting...
Probably not.
Huh?
Yeah.
All right,
he's saying there is a legal basis, but he didn't use the legal basis. He used an illegal, he used an unconstitutional
right, so
approach.
But if the president, let's say, has a limited grasp of constitutional law,
well,
then,
it's not
but,
the
but,
president that's
no, but
doing
what
this.
I'm
it's
saying is,
Justice Department.
If he makes a decision that he's allowed to make, does it matter what's going through his head when he makes that decision?
Well, it matters the law. I mean, they file, and it matters the law in which the legal. They used a legal basis to say we're going to end this on March 5th, and what the court is saying is, you can't use that as the legal basis. That's not constitutional.
All right, Alan, maybe one email here, maybe two, and then we'll break for news and then come back for the final third of the program.
This is a very important letter. How dare you, Alan?
All right,
on behalf of the newly formed Bard College Curling Club.
You see?
I am offended. Curling takes balance, strength, and employs great strategy. Please watch a full match before casting such aspersions on a beloved sport. Curling for life, and that's from Ruthie.
Ruthie, you're here, Ruthie.
You were warned, and, Alan.
Yes, you were.
Slap
yes,
him
I
down,
was.
Ruthie.
And Matt says, Alan, come curling. Dearest Alan, you would think we curlers would take umbrage at being insulted en masse, but our 500-year-old sport is all about camaraderie, tradition, and friendly play.
Yeah.
So we will laugh with you, but invite you to join us.
I think you'll laugh at him.
Is it a life sport that requires athleticism but also accommodates many levels of physical ability? Why don't you come try it? The Albany Club is having an open house this weekend, and the Schenectady Club in beautiful downtown Niskayuna is having its open house February 23rd to 24th. All are welcome. Love and pledges from Matt.
I will pay you $50 American dollars if you can go curling, and there is photographic proof of that. I'll tell you right now over the radio.
That
I want to see.
Let me take it under advisement.
You know, I think curling doesn't have referees. I think, if I know this correctly, some curling expert, please correct me, but I think that's self-policed or self-refereed.
I don't know. I feel like you look at the camera angles, and it's really, you have to make sure it's online and that
There's so much skill involved.
I think they work it out themselves.
I don't care. Kevin says
it's like bocce on ice.
I think curling's like bocce on ice.
Everybody, take a breath here. Bocce on ice. We're going to leave it on that thought. This is the roundtable panel. If you want to complain about Teresa Bourgeois' comment, feel free. The email address is panel@wamc.org. We'll break for news. We'll be right back. Don't get around. Wellington, ladies and gentlemen, here on the roundtable. It's 4 minutes after 10, I should say, coming up on 5 after 10. And it's the roundtable panel. We have Teresa Bourgeois here, Jen Smith, and Alan Shartok, and you at panel@wamc.org. panel@wamc.org. Alan Shartok is here, and he will read you some letters once he puts down his blasted phone. Go ahead.
From Kevin. What would the Founding Fathers think of gerrymandering and Citizens United? They must be rolling over in their graves.
They may just be.
They may be.
It's hard to verify that.
Or some of them may and some of them may not. Now, yeah. We will remember that George Washington spoke about, you know, the problem with factions, meaning political mm-hmm. parties. It's a little late for that now. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because now it's really disgusting. But thank you, Kevin.
Okay.
And Rick says, good morning, panel. Will Mueller be able to access Trump's tax returns? We've often gotten this question. And other financial docs that will finally outline how indebted our president is to the Russian oligarchs. Now, that's an interesting question, folks, and I'll tell you why. Will Mueller be able to get the tax returns? Well, let me ask you something, everybody. Do you think that there's anybody in prison right now for cheating on their taxes? Yes. And did the prosecutors get a hold of the tax returns? Yes, certainly. So could Mueller get those tax returns? I would think so, especially if he thought a potential crime had been committed. Right, Teresa? There's no question in my mind.
He can get them.
Sure.
Right.
But
yeah.
I think what we've seen with, you know, global issues like the Panama Papers, the Paradise Papers, is that it's well hidden. It's meant, you know, whatever sort of, if you're looking for something that can be incriminating, there are ways to bury it. So there's a lot of digging that needs to go on. I'd love to see the U.S., you know, media outlets collaborate on something like that to pull things together.
If Mueller can't do it, I wonder who can with the resources he has, right?
Okay. I mean, I just, you know me, I think just let's Mueller do his work and let, there's so many other things that we can focus attention on while he's doing his work.
No, but it's a fair question.
Yeah.
Can Mueller get the tax returns? The answer is yes.
It's a fact question, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Okay, and Carl says, if you were benefiting from collusion, would you acknowledge or try to stop it?
And the email address is panel@wamc.org. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday shrugged off police recommendations that he be charged with corruption, calling the allegations biased, extreme, and full of holes like Swiss cheese, and vowing to remain in office. Speaking at a local government meeting in Tel Aviv, Netanyahu said his government remains stable despite the police announcement and that the truth will come to light and nothing will come of this. He contended that the value of the gifts that police allege he received were inflated beyond recognition and accused the report of trying to create a false impression of exchanges that never existed. The police announcement late yesterday that Netanyahu accepted nearly $300,000 in gifts from two billionaires dealt the embattled prime minister a blow after years of investigations, but did not immediately appear to rattle his cabinet. Most of them issued statements of support. No coalition partners appeared ready to leave. Opposition politicians calling for his resignation. Who wants first?
Well, I don't know that I want first, but I will go first. And that is that Netanyahu would not be the first Israeli prime minister to come under this kind of problem and would not be the first, frankly, if he got convicted, to be convicted and put in jail. You know, it's interesting that the Israelis have a way, it seems to me, of dealing with somebody who stays around too long. Is there corruption? Well, I've spoken to many Israelis who will tell me that Netanyahu was going to be convicted and was going to get thrown out. And it's almost presumed, based on the kinds of stuff that has been in the Israeli press, that he is in real trouble. Now, what's interesting is that the Attorney General will have to, of Israel, will have to come on and say yes or no. And, of course, this is somebody who is closely tied to Netanyahu, but there is a different ethic in Israel than exists, for example, in the United States, where I don't think you would see Jeff Sessions coming along and saying, yes, I want to suggest that he, you know, that the president of the United States, Trump, go to jail. I think it's political, all right, but it's not political in the same way. So I suspect that Netanyahu is in real trouble.
Well, I would not entirely agree with that because what? I think Netanyahu said he told the BBC himself that this is like the 15th time he's faced such charges and, you know, he's gotten, you know, nothing's been brought to light. He's still in office. I think what's interesting about this case is, you know, what the charges are. And
bribery.
Who's connected. So one is an Israeli newspaper editor, and one is a U.S. film producer who has ties to, you know, Leonardo, our beloved Leonardo DiCaprio in films like Fight Club and The Revenants and stuff like that. So I think that makes that case a little bit more, you know, globally interesting. And I think what's also being talked about is, I think the precedent will change if the others, so if the editor and the filmmaker do have to answer to those charges, then that gives more case to actually firm up the charges against Netanyahu.
Well, you know, it brings to mind what we have in the United States under the McDonald decision, you know, so the charge is bribery. Somebody has given $200,000 worth of stuff to the Netanyahu's, more than one. Mm-hmm. And the question, as here, is, was there a quid pro quo? Did they get something back specifically for it? Under McDonnell, it's almost impossible these days to prove that that's the way it happens. You can, mm-hmm. but you got to catch somebody speaking on the telephone.
Right.
You know, so basically saying, if you do this for me, I'll do this for you.
In this case, it's, you know, in the case of the filmmaker, it's allegedly getting a visa. And in the case of the newspaper, it was to basically rein in a competing publication.
Yeah.
Alan, impact, if any, on the U.S.-Israeli, you know, relations. What is the U.S. policy in the Middle East, by the way?
Well, wait, before, I thought your first part of the question was excellent, really good. Which, I didn't mean to denigrate the second part, but the first part was really good. Here you have Trump under exactly the same kinds of charges.
And yeah. And the two of them so
are as
tightly
close as could be.
Close together.
Yeah.
So, because remember, President Obama kept his distance a bit from Netanyahu and was...
Although Mario Cuomo loved Bibi Netanyahu, I remember all of that stuff back in the day.
So, given how close they are, and given now that they share some problems, what impact at all on U.S.?
I think you're making the statement yourself, which is it's doubtful that the U.S. is going to come out against Netanyahu when you have Trump having his own problems along the same line.
I was more thinking they wouldn't get involved in it, but that it creates some internal problems in Israel, of course, right? And so
it's an image issue for sure.
Right.
Anything.
And so, and given how unstable the Middle East is right now,
sure.
Let's put it this way: so many complex issues underway right now in the Middle East. This adds to that complexity.
And let's remember that Netanyahu is still extremely popular in Israel. And the reason for that is there is a sense on the part of the Israeli population, many of whom Roselle and I know, who would be considered liberals, that there isn't a good alternative to keeping order in terms of, you know, the Arab, philosophy of driving the Israelis into the sea. It's very easy for us to say, well, you should be doing more. There should be more cooperation for a two-state solution. Nevertheless, if you're talking to the voters in Israel, they may come out with a different way of looking at it.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org if you want to weigh in. Panel@wamc.org. Seems to be parallels between the situation with Netanyahu and the situation here in that the reaction has fallen strictly along partisan lines. Netanyahu's coalition whip, David Amsalem, accused the police of committing, quote, an illegitimate act here to attempt a coup d'etat in Israel.
Sounds very familiar.
It does sound familiar. And what parallels then can we draw?
Well, as I said before, Netanyahu would not be the first Israeli prime minister to go to jail for this kind of thing. And there is a tradition of the police being sort of down the middle and being able to be forceful in terms of coming out with these kinds of accusations. So I think there may be a real big difference between the kind of fight you see there, although the same accusations, and what this president is saying about his own Justice Department and his own FBI.
Do you guys see the article on CNBC.com a day or two ago? New York Times CEO, print journalism has maybe 10 years to go.
Interesting.
Yes.
Do you see that?
Yeah. I've talked about it before. Rex Smith on our media project predicted it a long time ago.
Now, which one is Rex Smith?
He's the head guy who owns that program, the media project. And he's the editor of the Albany Times Union.
Oh, that's right.
And he made a prediction years ago that sooner or later they'd all disappear. What's making this one interesting is it's the New York Times guy who is saying it. Mm. And I suspect we will see a New York Times almost forever.
Well, and I think you have to look at the – I encourage anyone who cares about this issue to look at the full transcript. And he's not – he's specifically talking about the New York Times, for one, and it has to do with a deep analysis on its revenue model, right? So its digital subscribership has gone up exponentially, 300,000 digital subscribers in just the past year, which brings a significant amount of revenue. That revenue and growth percentage rates are really strong, but at the same time, they don't bring in the same kind of dollars that a print ad does. A full page ad in the New York Times. So it just presents this sort of new approach in a business model. If you look a little bit more, they've been talking about this issue. It came out recently again because they're on the Power Lunch show to talk about, I think, the recent quarter. They were talking about the same topic back in the fall after the elections because of the impact of what Trump coverage has. And, what moving forward, if you look at their 2020 model, you see interesting information that goes beyond just this issue, right? So one of the areas they're heavily investing in is $5 million just to cover Trump. They're also going to be reducing some staff. They're going to increase investing in digital advertising. They've got some reconfiguring. A lot of their, if you go to the New York Times website, you see a lot of digital products, right? So there's podcasts. They have a huge deal with Samsung to do 360-degree video, virtual reality. If you go to the museum down in Washington,
which is in deep financial trouble.
Yep.
Sadly.
Yep. But you see that on display. So it'll be interesting to look at what some of those decisions. You'll see a lot of movement at the top. They just promoted a new deputy managing editor, I believe, from their digital side. So what impact that'll have on the Times mission, the look, and the content that they're delivering, and how.
But how does it affect our culture and our politics if print journalism goes away, if you don't have that paper anymore?
To hold in your hand.
Yeah, and looking at it.
If you look at a little place like the one I work for called the Berkshire Eagle, we're not going to see that move very far away anytime soon, because you have to be realistic to your market. I think in the case of New York Times, they are having an increase in younger subscribers. They just made a deal with Snapchat, which evidences that movement as well. For us, for our regional papers, we still have a pretty older demographic in terms of who our subscribers are. We want to keep that. They're highly print subscribers. And so I think it's going to be different for every.
So how do you read the paper?
It depends.
I get up three times a night and I read the paper. I read the New York Times cover to cover online.
Yep. Yep.
And I'm an older guy.
Yep.
And then I read The Berkshire Eagle
yep.
when it comes out, you know, as soon as it comes out, and I read it online. Mm-hmm. However, I have to confess, since we are subscribers, that when I read the paper copy, mm-hmm. it's different than
right.
when I read it online. The pictures are different. The editorial has a different kind of significance when you're reading it from the editorial page.
Yeah, that's interesting.
As opposed to online. You know,
and also,
they see?
The little bit I've seen on this, on the research, too, is if you have a print paper in front of you, you're reading stories that you wouldn't otherwise go to. You're getting a broader
right.
array of information.
Exactly.
Because people tend to look online for that which they're, you know, they go to what they know. They listen to who they like.
It's more selective.
Right. But if you're going to learn a wider variety of things, I'm told, the research shows, if you look at a print paper.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org. And we have 3 or 4 or 5 minutes left here. Why don't we cover a few of the emails?
Anything you say, Chief.
All right, sir.
Civics at Chatham High School is from Lori. Dear friends, civics is alive and well at Chatham High School in Chatham, New York. My son is a senior and required to take one semester of government and one semester of economics. Each morning he's engaged in meaningful and well-informed debates with his peers, thanks to an excellent teacher. I am so grateful.
That's great.
My first time writing, Alan. Love what you all do, and that's Lori from Ghent.
Well, thanks,
civics
Lori.
In action.
Yeah,
yeah,
nice.
You're doing
democracy in action. I love
doing,
it.
You're a civic engagement.
And Bobby says,
Bobby,
Republican Party bad for national security. Good morning, panel.
Good morning.
Why wasn't the Republican Party brought up as a national security threat at the hearings yesterday? The GOP is the greatest threat to most Americans.
In what way?
I'm about to finish, if you would just
right.
allow me to do
all
that.
Right.
To,
all right.
You know, refusing to conduct oversight, taking away health care, denying climate change, refusing to govern, cutting funding to education, cutting immigration. The list goes on, and that's Bobby from Bennington.
You're right, Bobby.
Bobby.
Just one little tidbit from the infrastructure package that was proposed.
Yes.
You know, they laid it out and they said they had a big focus on vocational education, so you have people to do the work. Yet separately in the budget proposal that they put out, deep cuts in funding for vocational education.
Interesting.
It's just totally
the
crazy.
Same kind of hypocrisy.
Just like with the opioid crisis, same thing.
We've been seeing all along. And Jim says external influence. Dear panel.
Hello.
What about foreign press pushing an agenda in the USA? In other words, the Daily Mail or the Guardian to offer a couple of extremes from the UK, for example. And Jim, you're right. I read a lot of papers and I often go to the Guardian.
I love the Guardian.
Yeah. So, yeah. But it offers you sometimes the same perspective, but sometimes a different perspective. You know what I mean?
Right.
I suggest here's a little fun thing to do. Every day, pick one city somewhere in the world and look up their newspaper and just read one or two stories
and
online.
And don't look at the first page of listings. Scroll through a little bit more, and then you reduce a lot of the bias. You learn a lot.
Interesting.
Just pick a city and just look at their newspaper for that day.
Patrick says of Netanyahu,
yeah.
He's a criminal, just the same as Trump.
Okay.
There we go.
Patrick.
Thank you, Patrick.
Definitive. Okay, and Kathleen says, Trump's secret. Hello, panel.
Hello.
I like this one very, very much.
Oh, yes.
Hello, panel. Alan is correct.
Alan, they know how to get red.
Right.
To question why President Trump does nothing about Russian interference. What is he hiding? What are the goods, in quotes, that Putin has on him? Also, are Trump and the GOP hoping for more help from Russia during the upcoming midterms? And that's from Kathleen.
Well, thank you for all your letters today.
Lots of letters today. Jen
Smith, how do we find out more about what's going on in the Eagle? We have just a few minutes left. What's the website?
It. Yeah, you can come to BerkshireEagle.com.
Okay.
And we're on all the social media links. If you're in Pittsfield, 75 South Church Street, come visit
us. Just stop
us.
In the office.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a great idea.
It's,
and Teresa Bourgeois, you're on the Twitter, yeah?
Yeah, at T. Bush, at TBOUG. Follow me on Twitter.
Thank you very much. And Shartak, what's up with you?
You may call me Alan.
All right.
What is up with me?
Yeah, okay, we're done.
I don't know. I have to teach a class at noon.
You meant to say happy Valentine's Day to all our wonderful listeners.
And especially, yes, to all of you.
All right.
Especially to Roselle.
And on that happy note, we
bring your flowers, Alan.
Take
bring
a break,
flowers.
And there'll be more roundtables straight ahead.